Good afternoon. It's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper returns soon. Glad to have you with us. Well, death is never easy. It's a subject most of us would rather avoid, unless life dictates otherwise. Today, we visit with an award-winning NPR reporter and producer and author, Kate Sweeney. While pursuing her master's degree, she began spending time with obituary writers, funeral homeowners, and a variety of experts familiar with the world of death. Her thesis evolved into her latest book, American Afterlife: Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. And she joins us from NPR member station WABE in Atlanta, Georgia, where Kate Sweeney is a radio features producer and host. So welcome, Kate, and thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure, a pleasure. Now, you came to this subject sort of through the back door. You had never experienced the catastrophic death of a loved one yourself. So why this curiosity and interest in death and mourning?
Well, you know, I actually think that's a big part of it, although I didn't realize that at the outset, was that I had never experienced sort of a major catastrophic loss myself. There I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And, you know, I'm kind of one of those neurotic folks who's, you know, I got, you know, freaked out every time, you know, my husband would leave the house. I'd have to say like, oh, drive carefully because, you know, I was worried that he might be in an accident or something. But on another level, is like the world of death and memorialization is so chock full of really interesting trivia. I mean, because as you mentioned at the outset, it's something that we don't talk about very much. Soon I got to learn all about all these things that people don't know much about, the history of embalming fluid, you know, everything that goes into creating a funeral down to that little piece of astroturf that surrounds the grave, and all of this sort of interesting stuff that, you know, not only do you not talk about much, but is actually really fascinating, and some of it kind of, you know, it's entertaining trivia.
It's kind of ironic because it seems like we're fascinated with death, but we have a distaste for dealing with it.
Right. And it that wasn't always the case. And that was a really big discovery that I actually made in researching American Afterlife. You know, back in the 1800s, Americans really were, I wouldn't say that they were into death or that they enjoyed it. But I mean, if you think about it on a practical level, they experienced a lot more of it. And mourning culture at that point in time was really a big thing. I mean, somebody died, and no matter the person's relationship to you, you knew exactly what to do. You know, you knew how long to be in mourning, you knew what to wear, you knew exactly how to behave. Today, that's not so much the case. And in researching the book, I kind of discovered how we went from point A to point B, where we are today.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how we went from the 19th century. You said there was a death culture, really, then, into the early 20th. Let's go back and do a little history, will we?
Yeah, for sure, because it is really, really fascinating. Okay, so 1800s, we experienced a lot more death sort of in the everyday. You know, I'm 36 years old, and I might have been expected to have had, you know, a dozen or more children and have experienced the loss of, you know, 9 or 10 of them or something like that, and that would be absolutely normal. People experienced a lot more death. And death happened in the home, and dying happened in the home. There was a room in the house called the parlor, and I love this story. Everybody's heard of the parlor, right? It was the room where you might court your sweetheart, you know, on the Davenport. It was the room where you might get married. And then it was the room where your own funeral might take place in your house. The parlor was the room where life just happened. Then, around the turn of the 20th century, death started leaving the house. We saw the rise of great institutions like hospitals. And so death started leaving the house, you know, and dying did as well. We also saw the rise of the first standalone funeral businesses, which were called funeral chapels, or in a lot of cases, funeral parlors. Funeral directors named their new businesses after that room in the house where people had had funerals in order to gain their customers' trust, so they could let people know, look, you can turn all of this over to us and we will do it right. And then if you look again 10 or 20 years down the road from then, we were a little bit more removed from death. Our relationship with death was not as comfortable, and we pushed for renaming that room in the house. The parlor became the living room.
That's so great.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. I think that's just such a wild story.
Yeah, because you never think about it. I mean, that's what we call it, but the origins of it are really fascinating.
I know. And that was a push by women's magazines, I believe, at the time, who, you know, they looked at those parlors and they thought those were Victorian and dusty and musty and didn't get any light in them. And let's rename this room for sort of this new era of, you know, of health and medicine, when there was this belief that maybe medicine could surmount everything now because we have germ theory. Doctors even believed at some point medicine might even surmount death and overcome it completely. And you know, frankly, I don't know if we've really gotten beyond that attitude, this idea that medicine might surmount even that ultimate malady, death.
Well, I mean, our culture kind of leans toward that so heavily, and with extended life now, because of all the measures and all the new medications, I mean, it's actually, it looks as though that is happening.
To some degree, mm-hmm. Yeah. But if, and this is, you know, it's interesting. When I talk to people, current folks who found themselves involved with death and memorialization, everyone from a woman, you know, tending a roadside memorial for her daughter, to a third-generation funeral director, to obituary writers, what people told me sort of again and again is that when they experienced loss, they felt really sort of alienated from their normal everyday lives. You know, back in the day, in the 1800s, I mean, I'm not saying I would want to go live back then because I like germ theory, but when someone died, you knew what to do. You know, nowadays, you go to a funeral, you do all of that you're supposed to do with the funeral, but then, okay, you go back to work, and maybe your coworkers don't know how to talk with you, your colleagues don't really know how to talk with you, and you don't really know how to talk with them or how you're supposed to behave. Mm-hmm. And again, sort of, I talked with folks who found themselves sort of feeling bewildered by all of this, you know, really like thrown into the wilderness.
So it seems like death was actually easier, even though there was so much of it for the Victorians, because it was such a big part of their lives. And how long were they given to grieve? Because now, I mean, in the Jewish tradition, of course, we have the Shiva, which lasts right. A varying amount of time, which is very helpful. But that only lasts at most for about a week. So then you still have to go back to your life. How long did people have to grieve back in Victorian times?
It depended on your relationship with the deceased. So if you were the widow of the deceased, usually they'd say about 2 years. But there were rules for everybody. I mean, no matter the relationship to the person in your life. One set of rules I came across in an etiquette manual from the 1800s prescribed what you should do if you were the second wife of a man whose first wife's parents died. You had to go into mourning. And, you know, I don't remember exactly for how long, but there were different rules for everyone. I mean, for children, for maids of a household where, you know, the master died, all sorts of things. I mean, you have to remember, actually, this is the generation that invented the deathbed. You know, you think of like the deathbed scene, sort of old corny movies, mm-hmm. Which, and we don't really see that anymore. But the era that invented that was the Victorians. I mean, think about Charles Dickens and like little Ava in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and just sort of these sort of maudlin scenes. And yeah, they were super sentimental, but at the same time, they were something that people could identify with because, you know, most people walking the streets had seen someone die in their house.
When and why did photographing the dead become a custom?
Memorial photography. Now, this is something that I was really excited to investigate with this book, because before I started, there was sort of big before and after for me in writing American Afterlife. Before I wrote the book, I sort of thought, wow, memorial photography, that's weird. I didn't understand why anyone would want photographs of their dead, right? But and then I started investigating it, and you know, the way I thought about it really began to change. Memorial photography got its start with the advent of the camera, right? So late 1800s. And I mean, this was an era when they were inventing so many things, and the camera was one of them. So these were people, these Americans at this time, who highly valued this idea of the good death. And this was dying at home, surrounded by loved ones. And then ideally, since the idea sort of originally came from evangelical Christianity, being saved before you died. But the good death was so pervasive that this idea of dying at home surrounded by loved ones was really, really important to just about everybody living at the time. So memorial photography was first done by, you know, these traveling photographers who were sort of going from town to town. And the photographs that people got of their dead loved ones were often the only photos they would have of that person. And it also did a secondary thing, besides being the only photographic evidence they had of that that life had taken place. They were the only evidence that that person had died well, that a good death had taken place. So no matter the circumstances under which that person had actually died, you know, like in a tractor accident, or no matter what had actually happened, they could then pose the person to look like he or she had died peacefully. And then they would have that photograph that sort of stood as sort of proof for that. Now, you know, when investigating this book, I spoke with a woman named Juana Hogreef, who volunteered as a memorial photographer right now in this day and age for parents whose infants had died. And when I first talked to her, I didn't understand why people would want that. But you have this parallel, and I kept running into these parallels while investigating the book. These photographs of these infants might, again, be the only photos these parents have now, that they had had this relationship and that it had been important, you know, sort of when there might be an impulse with infants, you know, very young infants, to sort of downplay the importance of that relationship because, you know, it was only a baby. Oh, you know, the baby was only alive for a few days, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this might be the only chance the parents get to take the babies off of sort of life support machinery and actually hold the child, you know, without all those wires and tubes. And then there'll be photographic evidence that, you know, this was a real relationship. This really mattered.
Oh, that sounds like such a...
yeah, I know I'm talking your ear off, aren't I?
But no, I'm really happy. I'm happy to hear you. We're speaking with Kate Sweeney. She's a radio features producer and host at WABE in Atlanta. And she's won 3 Edward R. Murrow Awards, plus several awards from the Associated Press. She's also an author. Her latest book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll come back. And at some point soon, we'll open the phones and take your emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Kate Sweeney. She's a radio features producer and host at WABE. That's Atlanta's NPR station. She's also an author. And her latest book is American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. If you'd like to join in the conversation, tell us how you deal with grieving and mourning, death, that of a loved one, or how you deal with your own mortality, you can call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. So, Kate, tell us about the Museum of Funeral Customs, which is pretty amazing, in Springfield, Illinois. Sounds like an interesting place.
Oh, it was so wonderful. And rest in peace, Museum of Funeral Customs, for it is no more. It has closed down since I wrote the book, which just hurts my heart because John Austin, the curator of the Museum of Funeral Customs, put his heart and soul into that place. And really, I mean, okay, so the Museum of Funeral Customs was filled with displays of funeral, you know, sort of funeral displays that really represented really the 19th and 20th century. And so there were displays, for example, of mourning clothing from the 19th century, which was just breathtaking. And you kind of walked into that section of the museum and everything was black, and a lot of things were made of this material called crepe. Have you heard of funeral crepe?
I can't say I have. No.
So C-R-A-P-E. Now, this really amazed me. So this material was black. It was scratchy. It was made to be uncomfortable. And frankly, it was made to be ugly. And it trimmed just about every piece of mourning clothing that existed back then. It was wildly popular. There were companies that made their fortunes off of this stuff. And the wild thing about crepe, or one wild thing about crepe, is that it was actually made from silk, which, you know, is the most delicate, beautiful...
Soft.
Yeah, soft base material that you could have. And, you know, you think of crepe today, you might think of, like, these beautiful, fine dresses. It's the same material, only crepe at that point was sort of made to be stiff and hard and scratchy and, as I said, just really, really ugly stuff.
Now, how long did they have to wear this crepe or the, you know, this mourning clothing?
Yeah, that all went into these really complex rules of mourning etiquette and the stages of mourning. And so there was full mourning, there was half mourning, there were all of these different stages, and they differed depending on your relationship with the person who had died. So they were mainly, the rules of mourning mainly impacted women, and the largest impact came for widows. They were in official mourning for the longest, and there were some very strict rules here. One I came across said that, you know, the woman should take care not to wear anything that was even reflective. So no buttons that, even if they were black, they couldn't reflect the sunlight because that was a sort of brightness and that would show your disrespect for the dead. Mm. People were also wearing, as the sort of the 1800s marched along, really large pieces of mourning jewelry got to be like super popular. People made jewelry out of jet, which is this very, very heavy black material. And at one point, big chains of jet got to be very popular. And there are these big, heavy chains. And you think about these things and you think, gosh, you know, they're all, it's so unattractive and it's so unpleasant. Why would you want to do this? But then you think, heck, I mean, if you've experienced grief before, you know, you may not particularly want to be attractive and you may not particularly want to look pleasant at all. And so this was a way of sort of declaring that publicly.
Or be comfortable. What about this tradition? Yeah. I mean, maybe that was part of it, you know, to be so uncomfortable as a way of showing your respect and grief, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What about this tradition of wearing the jewelry made from the hair of a loved one?
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So at one point I was walking through the Museum of Funeral Customs and I came across a glass case and I saw there a watch fob. Like there was, you know, just sort of one of those old fashioned holders, like chains, like fob things you'd put on a pocket watch. And then I looked at the material and it said human hair. And I looked at it and I said, okay, where's the hair? I didn't see any hair. And I looked at it and then it just struck me all at once. Oh my goodness, this whole thing is made from human hair. Tiny little intricate braids. So 1800s, you know, this is the romantic era, right? So this is the time of people exchanging locks of hair with their loved ones or, you know, giving them to their mothers or their sweethearts or whatever. But this was also a time when people, you know, they were dying a lot. And of course, I mean, you know, people were dying of influenza, of childbirth, of, you know, the Civil War, heck, you know, like lots and lots of death people experienced all the time. So when your loved one died, you'd have this ready-made art, memento rather, that you know, sort of symbolized the person to you that you could hold on to for the rest of your life. And you know, the people in the Victorians were a romantic people, and so they liked to hold on to things like this. And we can look back at that and say that's a little strange or that's a little morbid, mm-hmm. but I just recently talked to a woman whose dog died and her husband gave her a bracelet, and enclosed in this little case in the bracelet was a lock of her dog's hair. Or think about all the things we do with ashes. You know, we make jewelry containing our loved one's ashes, and it's really not so far away from one practice to the other.
No, it's actually, I see there are lots of similarities. What are some mm-hmm. of the other findings at the museum and some other strange customs from that time, such as the cemeteries as a favorite courting spot? Really?
Oh, this was amazing. There's an entire chapter on the development of the cemetery. What I didn't realize is that the cemetery as we know it, as a place that we'd actually go visit and spend time in, did not exist until the 1800s. Before then, there were graveyards, but graveyards weren't places where people particularly wanted to spend a lot of time. You'd bury your family member, and then you would leave. And then what happened is around, I think it was 1790, there was a cemetery in downtown Paris, and this was a common concern everywhere, cemetery, or rather graveyard overcrowding. And there was this case of a graveyard which became so overcrowded that the coffins actually broke through the basement wall of a neighboring apartment building. Yeah. And there are these reports of sort of the mephitic gas sickening everyone in there. Uh-huh. And that really disgusting story is actually the beginning of how we got to sort of the golden age of cemeteries in the Western world. It led to the development of cemeteries like Père Lachaise Cemetery in France, places like Mount Auburn Cemetery and in Boston, Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta, and so many other places. And these were cemeteries that were really treated like they really were sort of the first big public parks. They predated sort of those Olmsted parks like Central Park by just a few years. And they were really sort of the first places that were sort of seen as places people could have sort of communion with nature, but they were sort of just outside the city center, and people could go and sort of walk around winding paths, and they would plant gardens on their loved ones' graves. And you're right, they became so popular for courting couples that I came across a satirical newspaper piece from Rochester, New York, in which this guy wrote these cemeteries are becoming so popular among these courting couples that we are soon to see the erection of saloons and body houses on their grounds. Because they were that much of a big deal. People loved to hang out in cemeteries in the 1800s.
Wow. That's really funny. And now I'm thinking how cemeteries are getting overcrowded. And you hear about stories about what they're doing about that.
Well, yeah, you hear a lot of stories about, the cemetery today is not what it was. I mean, they're... And what I hear from actually people who run cemeteries is that people visit them less and less and less. And so you end up with this problem of perpetual care. You know, who is going to care for the cemetery? After so many years, it's not the profitable business that it once was, because people are turning more and more to options like cremation. Cremation is actually predicted to outpace full body burial. Now, these are numbers from the Cremation Association of North America. They have predicted cremation to outpace sort of quote unquote traditional burial by 2016. And so cemetery operators, I mean, really, we're kind of in a lot of places looking at a situation of, heck, you know, I need some more business here.
But don't people, when they get cremated, put their ashes in an urn and put that in a cemetery often?
That is a great question. And many people do. Many people bury them in cemeteries or put them in columbariums, those sort of big, I think of them as card catalogs.
Right.
Those sort of walls, you know, and people can intern their ashes there.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother is actually interred in a columbarium at her church. But most of the ashes in the United States right now are actually sitting in people's basements, in boxes or in the back of their closets, because they haven't decided what they want to do with them. We see an uptick in people scattering their ashes at places that they love, you know, like the Grand Canyon or, you know, the ocean. Mm-hmm. Or a national park that the person loved during life. But it actually takes a lot of mourners some time to make that decision about what they want to do with the ashes. And it made me feel really good. And I imagine it felt good to put it in the book. Like, reader, don't feel bad if your father's ashes are still hanging out in the back of your closet and you haven't made that decision yet, because that is true for most people.
Yeah, it's really hard to decide what to do with them once you've done it. I also want to ask you, we need to take a break, though, about why you think cremations are increasing the way they are. But we'll do that when we get back. We're speaking with Kate Sweeney, and her latest book is American Afterlife: Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. Short break.
Thank you.
Well, it sounds funny to say welcome back to today's topical currents. We're speaking about death, but we are with award-winning NPR reporter and producer Kate Sweeney. Her book is American Afterlife: Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. We have some calls, but just to continue, so why do you think there's this uptick in cremations, Kate?
I think that it has to do with the fact that we don't stay in one place anymore. You think of the old-fashioned cemetery, you think of the family burial plot, but those were the days when generation after generation might have lived in one town or one city. But that rarely happens now. You know, I might live in a different place from where my parents live, my sisters live somewhere else, my brothers live somewhere else. And so when someone dies, you sort of, everybody has to travel to get to that one place. And there is no sort of old family home place anymore. And, you know, the cemetery was sort of, in days of old and in current days for many people still, but, you know, marks that one place that's sort of like home. You know, all the family is still together in that place that is home. But these days, you know, home is many, many different geographical places. And I think that is absolutely contributing to the continued rise of cremation.
Well, lots more to talk about, but we want to go to the phones because we have Amelis, I hope that's the way you say your name, waiting from Miami. Amelis?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi, I wanted to comment on how my mother mourned. In 1970, my father passed away, and we came to the States a month later, but my mother, I remember her not listening to music. She wouldn't go to parties, and she dressed in dark colors, blacks, browns, and grays. And that's just what we saw. And, you know, my mother passed away about a year and a half ago, and I found myself immediately dressing in dark colors. And I could not, when I opened up my closet, I could not wear that red shirt or that blue vest. I could not. I had to dress in dark colors. And I think that is a way of just showing respect. That's what I saw, and that's what I did with her. So, and my mother was cremated. We did exactly what she wanted. She wanted to be cremated, and her ashes spread out at sea. And it was hard for me to come to that. It did take me some time to spread those ashes. It was not easy.
Yes. Kate? Yeah. Amelis, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
How long was your, did your mother sort of remain in mourning?
Exactly a year.
One year. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, it is comforting. Like, it sounds like it was for you, you know, to be able to let people know, you know, I am in mourning. This did happen. And
exactly.
It sounds like that was certainly true for your mother and for you as well.
Yes, exactly.
You know, not
and
sort
also,
of.
Yes, and please. I'm sorry. Quickly, this is another thing I just wanted to comment on. I went to an antique show years ago, and I bought a very small ring, which was a hair ring. I wonder if you can comment or say something about that. And when I bought the ring, I opened it up. It was like a little glass, and there was tiny hairs inside, and I asked the person I purchased it from, and she said that was, I don't remember the year, but she said when babies died in the 1800s, they would buy these rings and put the, they would cut a little bit of the hair before burying the baby and put it in the ring, and the family would keep it. The mother would wear it for some time.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Hair jewelry was a really popular thing in the 1800s and early 1900s, you know, depending on the region of the country where you were. But yeah, it's interesting because it went from being something that was sort of everywhere and very, very popular to being seen as viewed as strange within a number of decades. Because if you look in craft magazines, like women's magazines from the late 1800s, you see craft projects on making hair jewelry. And if you look at some of the same magazines from the 1930s and 40s, they might have a column, and I found several such columns on, oh, we're going to look back at our past and what people used to do. And I found a couple like, oh, did you know Americans used to make jewelry out of human hair? Isn't it strange? Isn't it weird? And I mean, to think that this was the same magazine, you know, in a matter of decades, just these monumental changes took place, and pretty amazing.
Thanks, right. Emily.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So,
bye-bye.
So, Kate, you spent a lot of time with obituary writers. When did that tradition begin, and what did you learn from and about them?
Wow. You know, I sort of did a lot of research trying to find out when the first obituaries might have been. It's sort of been this form that has been long, long evolving. In one form or another, of course, we've always liked to write little stories or little profiles about our dead. Mm-hmm. And gosh, where to start? You know, in the 1990s and sort of the first decade of the 2000s, I think that obituary writing really experienced something of a renaissance. This was the time when we saw the rise of the everyman obituary. So when you're talking about obituaries, we're not just talking about the rich and famous, but also professionally, journalistically written obituaries about everyday non-famous people, just really well-written profiles. And sort of when we saw, and they're very, very popular, and obituaries in whatever form they take are still enormously popular. But we certainly did see, you know, with the newspaper industry kind of crashing, unfortunately, you know, we have seen that position, which had then at that point gone to some of the best writers at papers, you mm-hmm. know, the real veterans, real newspaper veterans who knew what the heck they were doing. Those are the people who also commanded the largest salaries. And so, you know, they left, they took buyouts. And that position of writing obituaries was again handed to sort of the greenhorn reporter who might also be writing like, you know, three or four or five other things that day. And,
right.
you know, expected to be tweeting and, you know, writing blogs and all of this sort of thing. And, you know, I would say that the form to some extent has suffered for that.
Did you find that when you spoke to them, did they ever get emotionally involved with the person they were writing about, or was it just this assignment and, I mean, they took it seriously, but did you ever find that?
That is a great question. I've talked to so many different obituary writers, but the one who stands out the most to me in respect to that question, did you ever feel emotionally involved with your subjects, is Kay Powell, who used to write for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And she would tell me, this was just her pet peeve when people asked her that. And she said, no, it's a news story. It just so happens to be about somebody who's dead. And I thought about that. That would be her answer over and over and over again. I mean, she would write these warts and all profiles of people. She would include the good and the bad and the ugly, you know, everything. And she hated, you know, she hated the cliches of obituaries, things like, you know, he never met a stranger. She would give you the shirt off her back, battled cancer. These phrases that have become sort of cliches because she believed in really good writing. And she's still alive. I'm talking about her in the past tense. But in her position, she believed in really good writing and she believed in journalism. And so she did not believe she was doing a service for the family. She was doing a service for the story. I mean, in the end, when I first asked her this, you know, I remember thinking, gosh, well, that's kind of a harsh answer. But then, you know, you think about, like, you know, the open heart surgeon.
Right.
You don't want, you know, don't want him or her to, that, like think of him or her, like, holding, you know, your heart and thinking, my goodness, I'm holding a beating human heart, you know? You don't want that person to be in awe. You just want her to do her job.
Exactly. We have more calls. I just want to ask you, though, you interviewed so many people for your thesis and for your book. How do you think it differs writing about someone who's alive? Many of the people who you write about are still alive, I mean, notwithstanding the museum, and about someone who's dead.
Wow. And this would be a really good question for some of the obituary writers I talked with, because they wrote about a lot of people who are dead, and I mostly talked with people who were alive about mm-hmm. their dead. And I mean, I think when it came down to that, for their craft, they would interview everyone. A really good obituary writer will interview everyone she can in order to really get a well-crafted profile. So not just talking with the wife, but talking with the person's drinking buddies, you know, that he met up with every Thursday night at the tavern, and also talking with, you know, the sister and the best friend and everyone, to really try to get a well-rounded profile. And actually, you know, when I think about it, that's kind of our job when we write about people who are alive, too.
Right.
Only we actually have the privilege of being able to talk with that person and get that first-person perspective as well.
We're speaking with Kate Sweeney. She's an award-winning radio producer and host at WABE in Atlanta, and her latest book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. One more short break, we'll come back, and Donna will take your call as soon as we get back. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, with award-winning NPR reporter and producer Kate Sweeney. Her latest book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. Donna, you've been waiting a long time, so welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi, thank you. Well, I'm a photographer, among other things, and I always find that I take pictures of what I love. And about 20 years ago, my sister died, and I wished I'd taken a picture of her even before she died. Anyway, years later, I took pictures of my mother and my father when they died, and other people who I got to be with when they died. Mm-hmm. And the first one, when I came up months later with the picture of my father, I was so happy. I mean, I felt weird. You know, like, this show has really helped, because I always felt weird. Am I weird or ghoulish taking pictures of the dead? And I think it's really good for people, and you preserve moments that are meaningful, mm-hmm. and people that you love.
Donna? I mean, Kate?
I'm really glad that you called in, Donna, because you're really pointing to something that that really hit home for me when I wrote the chapter about memorial photography for this book. Juana Hogreef, who photographs, who volunteers to photograph children who are, or rather infants who are dying, she volunteers to do this. You know, her perspective is a lot like yours. She photographs the things in her life that mean a lot to her at emotionally sharp moments. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, oh, actually, Kate, talking to myself, that's what you do too, because you're sitting here writing about this right now. Mm-hmm. I was driven to write this book because I had questions about memorialization and, gosh, what on earth to do when we lose our loved ones. And the idea was terrifying to me. And so what was I doing but writing about it, like so many, you know, like so many poets do, like songwriters do. They write music about things that frighten them. And photographers take photographs. And there's really not much of a difference there. And you can really make that comparison. You know, I remember one story that Juana told me that really stood out for me about, and it was sad, gosh, but like, you know, it was the story of some twins, and one was healthy and one wasn't, and they were only a few days old, and one twin did not make it. But she pointed out that years later, the surviving twin could like go into that drawer and get that photograph and see, oh my goodness, okay, I really did have a twin brother. This really did happen. This might not be the photograph that they would put out on in their front hallway, you know, or on the mantle, but it meant a lot to the surviving family.
Right. Thank you so much, Donna, for calling. I'd like to just mention, Kate, that in the last few months on Topical Currents, we've done at least 3 programs on dealing with end-of-life issues. When it became something that we were more...
You guys are riding the wave.
Yes. Well, there seems to be a lot of it. What do you think has changed? Is it all about baby boomers?
I think a lot of it has to do with baby boomers. And you're right. Oh, my goodness. We are seeing so many conversations about death and dying now. You know, from these from the proliferation of death cafes. Have you heard of death cafes? Are there any down there in Florida right now?
There may be that I haven't heard of them, though.
So these are grassroots groups, like gatherings of people who get together to talk about everything under the sun that has to do with death. And they're springing up all over the country. So you have things like that. You have things like the Conversation Project Online that is encouraging people to get together with their family members and talk about end of life issues, you know, sort of while they still can. Talk to your parents about what their wishes are and, you know, where those important documents are stored and, you know, all of that important stuff. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, just anyway, tons of conversations. And I think a lot of it does, as you say, have to do with the baby boomer generation. You know, these are the folks who have, you know, affected so much social change in their own lifetimes and have really reinvented the possibilities for major rites of passage. You know, oh, we can get married on the beach now. We can have babies at home once again. You know, and these are the folks who sort of reinvented that. And now, you know, they're kind of looking at this last rite of passage. A lot of people have experienced the loss of their own parents and kind of saw how that went down and are thinking, okay, when this happens to me, I want to have, you know, some modicum of control over how this happens, both my dying and, you know, my death, how I'm remembered and, you know, how my memorial goes. And yeah, I think we owe a lot of credit to baby boomers for finally reopening this conversation that, you know, I'm finding a lot of people actually really want to have. You know, at readings that I have of the book, people are really, really psyched to open up and, you know, oh gosh, I can finally tell stories that I've been wanting to tell about funerals that I've been to, whether they're, you know, funny stories or really sad stories. You know, I can share this this life experience without feeling like I'm being weird or inappropriate.
Let's talk to Dwight. He's been waiting for a long time in Pembroke Pines, speaking of modern methods of mourning. Hi, Dwight. Welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi, it's a great topic. You know, you just took the words right out of my mouth. You know, everyone, you know, has someone that has passed away, you know, unfortunately, you know, I mean, that's the world we're living in. And I just find a great comfort that I could go to these people's Facebook pages that are still active and people are doing exactly that. They're sharing stories, they're sharing pictures. You know, they're not professional photographers, but, you know, this is the gallery, if you will, you know, and I like it. And it's not often that you go there, but, you know, for whatever reason, Facebook will remind you, hey, you haven't talked to so-and-so in a while. And you're like, oh, so-and-so's dead, but, hey, let's go to their page. Oh, my God, I remember that party. Oh, where did these pictures come from? You know, so I think it's, you know, well, anyway, and so that's that one point. The second point is, so cemeteries are a losing proposition financially. What happens to the old cemetery and all the bodies that are in it? I'll take my question off the air.
Okay.
Off the air.
Okay, thanks, Dwight. Kate?
Well, I mean, a lot of times the cemeteries do have perpetual care funds that the families have funded. And so, you know, the bodies that are there, you know, the loved ones who are there, they're pretty much, you know, they're going to be okay. But in talking with funeral directors, yeah, I mean, you're right. It is kind of a losing proposition financially in the long run because they're not making, you know, boku dollars off of this. You know, the money goes back to fund the upkeep, the maintenance of the cemetery. And then, you know, we're also seeing the rise of, you know, new kinds of burial nowadays, things like green burial, which is absolutely on the rise, ecologically friendly burial cemeteries. Which are a very sort of different kind of thing from traditional cemeteries because sort of the conservation mandate is really at the forefront more than, hey, I want to put up a stone that, you know, with my name on it. So more important than necessarily, okay, I want to be remembered for all time is, you know, I want my you know, personal emphasis on conservation to be remembered for all time.
And how much has that grown, the green burial industry? I would think that might be, I mean, is that a big trend now?
Oh, it is really a trend. When I first started following, oh, first I'll say what green burial is just real quickly. So I don't feel like I really gave a really strong definition of
okay,
that.
Go
so
ahead.
We're talking about ecologically friendly burial. So It's burial without embalming, without metal clasps on caskets, without anything that doesn't biodegrade down to nothing. And at conservation burial cemeteries, the emphasis is on conserving that land. And when I first started covering this trend in 2007, there were 4 green burial cemeteries in the United States. When I last checked in with the Green Burial Council in last November 2013, there were 40 conservation burial cemeteries in this country. So
it's growing.
Yeah, it really is growing. And again, you know, in part, we do have the boomers to look at for that trend because, you know, think about the environmental movement and when it really sort of got the most recent version of it got moving in the late 1960s and 1970s. There are a lot of folks who really value conservation as, you know, hold that as a really core value. And they're making that as their final statement on this earth.
I thought embalming was mandatory.
No, and that is such a common misconception. Isn't that amazing? Almost so many people I talk to think, okay, well, if you're not, certainly embalming has to be required by law, but it's not in any of the 50 states. Mm. And that goes along with so many misconceptions when it comes to what is required and what is not. When it comes to burial, to interment, a lot of people think that vaults are also required by law. Those big concrete or metal boxes that go around caskets, those are not required by law either. What they are is required by a lot of conventional, I would say, cemeteries, because they keep the ground from caving in once the earth has settled.
Oh.
If you think about a time that maybe you've walked through a really old cemetery, maybe from the 1800s, and as you walk along, you can see that the ground kind of dips in over every burial. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't happen with sort of our new, you know, burial parks that we have now because of vaults. And the story of the burial vault really is fascinating. I mean, it's one of those things that has sort of changed its function. It was invented in the 1800s to prevent grave robbers, because that was a problem in the 1800s. You know, people robbing graves and selling those bodies to medical students. But they've sort of stuck around, you know, to keep the soil from caving in at cemeteries, like I said. And then a lot of funeral directors sell them on the basis of their ability to conserve that body and to keep it from the elements, to preserve bodies, really. Because they say, oh, you know, this is a great vault. It's top of the line, and it's going to protect this body from oxygen and from water, which basically preserves it.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. There are so many more questions, but I know you're pretty young, but has writing this book and your thesis, has it led you to think about your own death and wishes for your burial?
It absolutely has. And although, you know, I've kind of decided that I'm not really going to go public with what that decision is, I have decided. Here I am. I'm 36 years old. And who would think that somebody my age has made her plans for how she wants to be memorialized? But I have. And it's writing this book that caused me to do that.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Kate Sweeney is an award-winning radio producer and host at WABE Atlanta. We'll have a link to her book, American Afterlife, Encounters in the Customs of Mourning. Thank you so much, Kate, for joining us today. And I'm sorry,
Bonnie,
to the callers.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. Thanks for joining us. Our producers, Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary, free audio archives and downloads at WLRN.org. And tomorrow, we'll document the life and legacy of David Fairchild and Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great day. Please stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News. Thanks for joining us.